We've talked about the sort of the building blocks and the biology. The last thing we want to talk about is how does this get integrated into a treatment decision? And we could talk a lot about the treatment of relapse disease, their new agents, PI3 kinase inhibitors, but that can be for another time. Because what we really want to focus on is what's been discussed a tremendous amount this past year or two, which is first-line therapy, starting first-line therapy. We're going to walk through that and some of the issues that are considered, particularly in trying to decide what to do. And Brad, this also gets into the question of, do you even need to treat a patient? Well, we were talking before about the fact that things like DEL17P, TP53 are harder to treat, don't respond to chemotherapy. But just the fact that you have that, or these any markers or prognosis that are poor, Brad, or a white count, for example, that's very high, is that enough to get you to treat a patient with CLL, Brad?
Yeah, neither of those things are enough to treat. I've certainly seen my fair share of patients who have deletion 17P at diagnosis, but they have RI stage 0 or RI stage 1 disease asymptomatic, and we'll just start them on observation. And they can be observed for years, just like people without 17P deletion. So there's no reason to rush to treatment if you have a 17P deletion. And again, the white blood cell count, just having a high white blood cell count by itself is not a reason to initiate treatment.
And Brad, you put this slide together, really fantastic concept slide. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I should say courtesy of Danielle Brander on the bottom, because she sent me this slide. So all credit to Danielle. This just shows graphically that a proportion of patients, maybe a third, will never need their CLL treatment. So, gee, aren't you glad you never started those people on CLL therapy, because they literally never need it. And about a third will need to start treatment close to their time of diagnosis. And then about another third will not need treatment right away. But as you follow them over time, their disease will advance to the point where it's appropriate to start treatment.
And of course, you know, every patient is an individual. You can't make any rules for what the treatment you're going to use, but you have to consider the patient and their specific needs and interests, and also comorbidities, their age, et cetera. So many factors that have to be considered, including whether or not they're even going to be treated. And again, Brad put these concept things together and wanted the whole group to decide. And Jeff, maybe you can react to this real summary of a lot of complex thinking. But Brad, again, can you walk through in your mind how you think through what you're going to do?
So I put a menu on the left, our good old standard immunochemotherapy regimens that we used for many years successfully. I have our most commonly used novel agents. And so here's six pretty good options. And how do you choose? How do you decide? So we know based on some biomarkers now that some biomarker determinations can help you whittle that list down. We know that if patients have a 17P deletion or P53 mutation, chemotherapy is not very effective. You're clearly better off with novel agents. If the patients are IGHV unmutated, chemo is clearly less effective than novel agents. That's not to say that chemo is ineffective, and so you still might have situations where you opt for chemotherapy. Maybe the patient's copays are too high. Maybe the patient is just unreliable. I've had patients with mental health issues that they honestly just couldn't be trusted to take the pills. So I said, you know what? You're getting bendamustine rituximab because I can see you in clinic once a month and I know you're getting what we intend to give you. So there's always caveats. But in general, if you're IGHV unmutated, you're better off with novel agents. Where things get the trickiest is when you're IGHV mutated, because then everything works well and it's a complicated pro versus con discussion with the patients about all of these different options.
Jeff, would you like to provide your perspective on this sort of schematic?
Yeah, those are many of the same considerations I think that a lot of us think of. You know, in the NCCN guidelines right now, what they list is preferred agents and then other agents. The preferred agents in the NCCN guidelines are universally targeted agents, and then the other include the chemoimmunotherapy regimens. And I guess now I start with the default presumption that most patients are going to be treated with novel therapies. I would certainly echo the sentiment Brad mentions that there are just sometimes, whether for social reasons or what have you, chemotherapy may make sense, and I wouldn't fault that choice outside of a 17P. I guess I wouldn't fault that choice. But I start with the presumption that most patients are going to get novel agent. What I think is one of the discussions that's happening more often than not, patients nowadays will oftentimes come in and say things like, well, how long do I need to take this ibrutinib? Is this ibrutinib forever? And I think that there's some way in which we just still haven't been able to shake the notion that this is an anti-cancer therapy. And even though it's targeted, even though it has fewer toxicities, there's something about a daily pill that patients just resist. And so the time-limited therapy approach of obinutuzumab venetoclax is very appealing for those patients for whom taking a regular daily medication might be problematic.
So we're going to quickly go through a few basic scenarios that often come up in practice and talk about how they're generally managed. Then we're going to finish out with a case. But before we do, just go back to Amy. And we talk about taking drugs for years. This patient took it for 5 years. What are some of the quality of life issues that come up with BTK inhibitors? You mentioned a few of them, but I'm curious specifically, for example, about arthralgias, Amy, and other specific syndromes that you see.
Yeah, so the arthralgias are, they're tough. When patients have arthralgias with BTK inhibitors, I find them to linger on longer than, say, the nausea and the bowel changes. And then we recently had a great paper put out with long-term side effects or long-term toxicity and just the rate of hypertension going up over time and the hyperglycemia issues with our BTK inhibitors too. So just, I think some of the difficult discussions that we have had over time with our patients is we have tons of long-term follow-up data on our chemoimmunotherapy options. And then we have these novel agents that we don't have those 5, 10, 15, 20 year follow-up data on. But we're getting there with ibrutinib for sure. And the others will come along. But those are also part of the discussion when you're talking to patients about our novel agents versus our good old friends that we'd use very, very infrequently.
The other thing that we mentioned, Robin, about BTK inhibitors is bleeding. Can you talk a little bit about how this typically presents in a patient, what kind of bleeding you normally see with BTK inhibitors?
Typically, as I mentioned earlier, it'll be like bruising, petechiae, something like that. I have had a couple of patients with nosebleeds and even one individual who was getting the recurrent sinusitis and things and ear infections, and he would have bleeding out of his ears. I haven't seen that a lot, but I have another lady who was on a different BTK inhibitor and she had to reduce the dose because she was getting hematomas actually, but she did well with reducing the dose.
And of course, with several BTK inhibitors, trials are not trying to determine whether maybe some one or more might be safer, less bleeding, atrial fibrillation, another issue that can occur and maybe different, for example, less with acalabrutinib. Let's go through a few of the scenarios that Brad put together. And Jeff, maybe you can react to this first one. So a younger patient. So the two things that we're looking at is P53 and 17P, because we know if either one of those are present, then chemo is not going to be helpful. So we're saying they don't have that. It's unmutated. And Jeff, according to Brad, at least this patient should get some kind of novel therapy, either venetoclax or a BTK plus obinutuzumab. Any thoughts about that?
This is a guy who, with his age and unmutated CLL, I mean, you really do need to think about the sequencing and be thinking 2-3 therapies down the road. But with unmutated B-cell receptor, we know that the data for FCR and BR, you take on a reasonable amount of toxicity. And on a 52-year-old or 53-year-old, you would be, historically, you might have even been thinking FCR, yet you're probably only going to get 3.5 to 4.5 years out of FCR. Which, for the amount of toxicity you accept to get that, I feel like you're going to be better off with a novel agent. I think it could be an open discussion about obinutuzumab venetoclax or a BTK inhibitor. However, as we're seeing longer-term follow-up on the venetoclax data, we're starting to see the curve separate between the mutated and unmutated population. So I would probably, in this patient, err towards a BTK inhibitor. In our ELEVATE study, we did publish the data, although we didn't make it totally obvious because we didn't know how to interpret it ourselves. But the preponderance of the benefit for the addition of CD20 occurred in those patients who were IGHV mutated rather than those who were unmutated. So this is a patient I would probably go with a BTK monotherapy.
So I encourage you to look through the slides. We're not going through all those. We have a bunch of clinical scenarios that we go through here. Also, there's some really interesting presentations we're going to let you take a look at as we move on.